The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
From the variety of our individual spaces, let us come together and prepare for worship with this prelude.
Wasting your time with this garbage. Now go to bed!
Okay.
Just off the last half. Better at bat, count 3-2. He's been batting it at 600 average all season. Johnson checks the runner, gets the single, down the bench. Gets the short hopper, left center field. Maselli hustles up, the throw! Safe! Well, how's that?
Eat this.
I'm afraid your father's going to be very upset when he gets back.
May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and wonder to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Through the miracle of the internet, we are once again reminded that we are not isolated beings. Despite our physical distance, we can still feel the connection, the mystery, the miracle of our connection to this universe, connection to each other and to ourselves. You make this community this morning. You who want to so badly be present in person. You who are so thankful that you don't have to drive anywhere this morning. You with hope in your heart. You with overwhelming despair. We are a variety and welcoming community made whole by your presence. Thank you for being here today. I am Reverend Andrew Weber, a white minister serving here among so many other ministers. We each have stories to tell, stories about our lives and our dreams, and in the sharing and listening, we are ministers to each other. So come, let us enter into ministry of multitudes on this morning of possibilities. Each morning we light our flaming chalice, the symbol of our free and challenging faith. I invite each of you this morning to kindle your own flames. Get your personal chalice or a candle or other light to kindle in your personal sanctuary. There's actually an app called Worship Web, which has words for worship and a virtual chalice. And I'm going to send a link to you. There you go. There's a link for Google and Apple. If you want to get that app, then you can kindle the flame of Unitarian Universalism virtually whenever you have your phone handy. So please light your chalice as I read these words for reflection. Each of us is born with a box of matches inside us, but we can't strike them all by ourselves. We need oxygen and a candle to help. In this case, the oxygen, for example, would come from the breath of the person you love. The candle would be any kind of food, music, caress, word, or sound that engenders the explosion that lights one of the matches. For a moment, we are dazzled by an intense emotion. A pleasant warmth grows within us, fading slowly as time goes by until a new explosion comes along to revive it. Each person has to discover what will set off those explosions in order to live, since the combustion that occurs when one of them is ignited is what nourishes the soul. Let us kindle a second flame in our hearts and in our souls this morning, a lamp of peace ignited in our very essence, reminding us to be peaceful in our interactions while striving for peace in the world. And there are our chalice and our peace lamp lit in the sanctuary. Thank you, John. I will say the first words, and if you respond, even though muted, respond together. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world. We are singing today away from each other. Our first hymn is Gather the Spirit. Please feel free to join. If we unmuted, it would be cacophony. So remain muted, but feel free to sing out and sing loud with whomever you are with physically this morning. Gather the Spirit.
Witness the mystery.
Our story today is the sandwich swap. And I'm going to read it here as John flips through the slides. So I don't need to worry about showing you the picture. The sandwich swap. It all began with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And it ended with a hummus sandwich. Salma and Lily were best friends at school. They drew pictures together. They played on the swings together. They jumped rope together. And they ate their lunches together. But just what they ate was a little different. Lily ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day for lunch. Salma ate a hummus and pita sandwich every day for lunch. And although Lily never said it out loud, she thought Salma's sandwich looked weird and yucky. She felt terrible that her friend had to eat that icky chickpea paste every day. Ew, yuck. And although Salma never said it out loud, she thought Lily's sandwich looked strange and gross. She felt just awful that her friend had to eat that gooey peanut paste every day. Ew, gross. Then one day, Lily just couldn't hold back those pesky thoughts any longer. "Your sandwich looks kind of yucky," she blurted out. "What did you say?" Salma asked, thinking she must have misunderstood her friend. "I said your sandwich looks yucky." Salma frowned. She looked down at the thin, soft bread, and she thought of her beautiful, smiling mother as she carefully cut Salma's sandwich into two neat halves that morning. Her hurt feelings turned mad. "Yeah, well, your sandwich looks gross and it smells bad too," Salma snapped back. Lily looked surprised. She sniffed the thick, squishy bread and she thought of her dad in his silly apron, whistling as he cut Lily's sandwich into two perfect triangles that morning. Lily scowled. "It does not smell bad. It does too. Ew, yuck, ew, gross." That afternoon, the friends did not draw pictures together. They did not swing together and they did not jump rope together either. The next day, Salma ate her lunch at one table and Lily ate her lunch at another. Meanwhile, the peanut butter versus hummus story had spread and everyone began choosing sides. Each side had something not so nice to say to each other. "Peanut butter breath, jelly heads, garlic breath, chickpea brains." Pretty soon, the rude insults had nothing at all to do with peanut butter or hummus. "You're weird, you're stupid, you look funny, you dress dumb." And then it happened. Somebody yelled, "Food fight!" Peanut butter and hummus sandwiches and other lunch favorites began flying back and forth between both sides of the lunchroom. They stuck to walls, they stuck to the ceiling, they stuck to the lunch lady. When the sandwiches were all gone, pudding cups and applesauce and carrot sticks took flight. Salma and Lily looked at one another from across the rowdy, splattered room. They both felt ashamed at what they saw. They both felt really ashamed when the principal called them into her office after they had helped clean up the mess. The following day, Salma set her lunch down across from Lily's. The two girls nibbled on their sandwiches in silence. Finally, Lily got up the courage to speak. "Would you like to try a bite of my peanut butter and jelly?" Salma grinned. "Sure, why not? Would you like to try my hummus and pita?" Lily laughed. "I'd like that." "On the count of three." "Okay, on the count of three. 1, 2, 3. Mmm, yummy. Hey, this is delicious. And this is heavenly." The girls giggled and hugged and traded sandwiches. After lunch, Selma and Lily met with the principal again. This time, they were there to suggest a very special event for the whole school. And that's how it all began. with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and ended with a hummus and pita sandwich. And in addition to our story this morning, which talks about the stories we hold in our hearts and our backgrounds and our identities and how to be caring and loving friends, we have the honor of hearing Indigo share with us an essay she wrote. So Indigo, please.
Okay, so Dr. King's words and actions can be an influence on today's generation. One way that he expresses nonviolence as a gift of love and is that we should learn to love our enemies. Even today, hate just inspires more hatred. We, as Dr. King said, need to outbalance the hate with our love. This is why I aspire to spread love in my community by being welcoming to all people. Love can save us from hate. Hate just makes things worse. Dr. King was arrested and put in an awful jail, but he still held his ground and kept protesting. After a while, he got what he was fighting for. He stayed strong and got all white-only signs removed from lunch counters. He shows us that however hard the task at hand is, hold your ground. If you work hard enough, you might just get what you're fighting for. Dr. King was a spokesman of Montgomery Improvement Association's segregation protests on the city's buses at the age of 20. This shows us that young people can accomplish many important things. You are never too young to make a difference. Dr. King said, "We must keep moving. We must keep going. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But by all means, keep moving. Every time I want to stop demonstrating what is right, his words echo in my ear, ringing like the bell of freedom."
Absolutely wonderful, Indigo. Thank you so much. That was an essay which, correct me if I'm wrong, won an essay contest last year. So it's wonderfully written. Thank you for that.
It was Ursinus's contest.
Essay contest at Ursinus, which Indigo won. Thank you. We are going to sing Go Now in Peace. You may sing that just let's have it up. We usually sing this a cappella, so sing an a cappella. I'm gonna mute myself and sing, and if anyone needs to go and get an extra cup of tea or what you need to do, go and come back. Our second reading is by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whom we had a great introduction to. And this is from his Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. In his words, "We are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent than for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt as individuals and as institutions. The government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, When we stand to sing, in Christ there is no East or West, we stand in the most segregated hour of America. "50 years ago, he said this. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. So how are we doing? How are we doing 50 years later? I think it's actually 51. I think this was 64, 1964. So where are we? Does racism still permeate and poison our culture? Do we still have racism and racial issues that define us and our interactions? Well, I would start this off by talking about what is race, right? What is being Black or mixed or Latino or a person of color? What does that label mean? What is our racial identity? Many people who have light skin, if asked, what is your racial identity, right? If someone asked me, what is your racial identity? I would probably say, none. I don't really have a racial identity. And that is part of the problem. That's part of the problem, because we all have a racial identity, and not being conscious of it usually means we have some privilege there. And that's true with any privilege, right? With any privilege, if I don't have to think about my gender presentation when I'm out for a walk in the dark, if going on a date with my partner isn't a big deal because of how others will or will not react to us, if decisions at the grocery store don't have to be balanced with decisions at the doctor, if I don't have to think about those things, then those may be places that I have some privilege. Today, we're talking specifically about the story of race. And my first acknowledgement here is that I am speaking from a place of privilege. Merely because what I look like, I'm able to engage in the world and not constantly think about my racial identity. That being said, there are times when each one of us has our racial identity, our whiteness, our Blackness, our mixedness, our otherness called into consciousness. And in order to understand what racial identity is, I'm going to share a time when I truly felt white. And the thing about racial identity is it's not always us putting the identity on us. It could be someone else or some other group. This is a story about when I felt really white during my graduate studies. And it's telling. It's telling that my story comes from my graduate studies, not very early in my life, my 20s. During my graduate studies, I was walking to class one day and there was someone handing out leaflets. I don't know, for a product or a party or sale. I don't know what it was. I declined it. And I didn't think anything of it until I got into class. And there was a discussion going on with my classmates about that flyer. And one of my classmates hadn't been offered a flyer. And she thought that she wasn't offered the flyer because she was Black. She felt slighted, as if the color of her skin had made the person not offer whatever it was that was being handed out. Now, I don't know whether the person handing out the flyer was treating people differently based on the color of their skin. I have no idea. And it's quite possible that that's exactly what was happening, that the flyers were only handed out to white presenting people. But what I do know is that my classmate felt that the color of her skin impacted how people treated her, right? It didn't even cross my mind that I was treated differently because I was white. And that's part of the issue, right? That's part of it. I don't think about the color of my skin. I can very easily live in our culture without thinking about my racial identity, right? That's central to my white identity. That's central to white privilege, if you want to call it that, is that the ability is there that I can ignore it. So there's something there. There was something, some difference in how we interacted in the world, me and my classmate with darker skin. What is that difference? Right? We interacted differently. And what is that? Is that race? And if so, what is race? I mean, here are the, I think, really big questions. Like, can you tell just by looking at me what race I am? That I'm white? Some people would say yes. Can you tell from looking at me how I act in the world and what I value? That one may be not as easy. Does knowing the tone of my skin tell you anything about my personality? We are Unitarian Universalists, and from our Unitarian past and well into our present, a lot of what we want are facts and figures. We want data. I want numbers. I want to see this proven. I want reason, right? I want something behind it so I can go home, or I can do it right now and I can check. Hold on, he just said this. I'm going to look it up, right? Well, here we go. There's no basis. There's no basis for race in facts, reason, or science. The very existence of race has no basis in science. Go ahead. No, you can. This is where you all get out your devices, check it, and email me. It's like, Andrew, I actually found, please. Jared Diamond, who's best known for his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, right? That's Jared Diamond. He did extensive research into the field of anthropology, evolutionary biology, genetics, and ecology. And in a 1994 article, a little dated, but in his article, Race Without Color, this is in Discovery Magazine, Diamond states, science often violates common sense. Our eyes tell us that the world is flat, that the sun revolves around the earth, and that we humans are not animals. But we now ignore the evidence of our senses. We have learned that our earth is in fact round, and that it revolves around the sun, and that humans are slightly modified chimpanzees. The reality of human races is another common sense truth destined to follow the flat earth into oblivion. As it turns out, this seemingly unassailable reasoning is not obvious. There are many different, equally valid procedures for defining races, and those different procedures yield very different classifications. One such procedure would group Italians and Greeks with most African blacks. It would classify Xhosas, the South African black group to which President Nelson Mandela belongs, with Swedes rather than Nigerians. Another equally valid procedure would place Swedes and Fulani, a Nigerian black group, not with Italians, who would again be grouped with most other African blacks. Still another procedure would keep Swedes and Italians separate from all African blacks, but would throw the Swedes and Italians into the same race as New Guineans and American Indians. Faced with such differing classifications, many anthropologists today conclude that one cannot recognize any human race at all. Wow. Race is not something that can be measured, tabulated, or objectively studied. Race is subjective. And more often than that, it's culturally constructed identity. Now, this is to say that race still exists, that my interactions in the world were very different from my classmates. Race is an identity which we humans create, we take for ourselves, we push onto others, we thrust under our children. Now, that being said, it makes a lot of sense. This makes a lot of sense what we do. In general, humans are compartmentalized thinkers. We understand the world by categorizing and compartmentalizing that which we experience. I have an idea of what a bird is. So when someone says bird, it brings up an image, a thought, a sound, past experiences for bird. I know it generally what to expect, right? So it is with other humans. When I meet a person, my mind automatically works to find a category to put them into. And I have different expectations of the actions, say, a well-groomed middle-aged woman in a skirt I meet in a coffee shop, as opposed to the elderly, unkempt man in a torn trench coat I meet outside the coffee shop. I put them in boxes of what I expect. My expectations of them are made by the internalized cultural identities which I and which others have created for them. And this is the same for race. Unitarian Universalist Minister Tandaka, in her book, Learning to Be White, where the sermon title comes from, and if any of you want to borrow this book, it's very enlightening and challenging. You may. She starts off by saying, no one is born white in America. I was not born white. Sure, I may have been born with skin color close to this or a little pinker, but I had no identity associated with the term white. There's nothing inherent in my persona which makes me white or another person black. The pigmentation of human beings' skin is just one way we use to categorize those with whom we interact, and not a very good method. So where does this identity come from? How do I identify as white or as black or as mixed or Latino, any other racial identity? Now we are taught. We're taught explicitly, we're taught implicitly about our race. This process of learning to be white is the crux of Tandekka's book. And throughout her book, Tandekka weaves stories of Euro-Americans and how they came to identify as white. And I find it especially interesting in our culture where whiteness is the unspoken norm. Listen to these words of Toni Morrison. In this country, American means white. Everybody else has to hyphenate. Right? Introducing a speaker as a prominent Black theologian does not sound as strange as a prominent white theologian. In my introduction, I said, I am Andrew Weber, white minister. I labeled myself as white. Did that make you feel uncomfortable? It made me uncomfortable. Our culture assumes that people are white. That's what our culture does. It assumes people are white and therefore keeps that identity somewhat hidden, somewhat unspoken. So how many of you have a white identity? You don't need to raise your hands. You may, but like, how many of you are like, oh yeah, I have a white identity? That's an uncomfortable question. In general, those with light skin pigmentation don't identify, don't say like, yeah, I am white. But we expect those who we compartmentalize as black to have a black identity. Tandekka, during one of her interviews, was asked by a white lady what it felt like to be black. Tandekka took the question and turned it into a game she challenged people to play. And I actually introduced this game at the potluck last week. And the reaction is, it's difficult. It's hard. It's challenging. Hear her words. Tandekka says, I had been assigned a race by America's pervasive socialization process, and so had she. I thus believed that if she drew upon her own experiences of being raced, she might then be able to see what we had in common. But how could I make her conscious of the racialization process to which her own Euro-American community had subjected her? Searching for an answer to this question, I invented the race game and invited her to play it. For 1 week. The race game has only one rule. For the next 7 days, she must use the ascriptive term white whenever she mentioned the name of one of her Euro-American cohorts. She must say, for instance, my white husband, Phil, or my white friend, Julie, or my lovely white child, Jackie. I guaranteed her that if she did this for a week, and then met me for lunch, I could answer her question. That's what I did in my introduction. I said, I'm Reverend Andrew, a white minister. The use of this term by Euro-Americans countermands the general assumption held that being white is not a conscious part of our personal identity structure, right? We don't need to say white because that's the understood norm. When you read a book, if it describes characters, usually it says nothing about the color of their skin unless it's non-white. White people don't usually think of themselves as white. Instead, we reserve racial description for people who are non-white. We use racial descriptions for a person of color, color meaning a color other than this. The race game takes that normative unspoken label of being white and brings it into the forefront of consciousness, right? This purposefully puts everyone in a very awkward, very, very awkward situation where the unspoken and often sometimes shameful identity of whiteness is brought into light. So maybe you will try the race game. Maybe you will just think about playing the race game. When you think about it, really take the time to see how engaging with this would make you feel, right? Identify what is happening in your mind or your heart that makes this impossible or uncomfortable. I've never done it. I've preached about this and I say, oh, I'd love to hear what happens to you. I could not do this, right? Why is it that identifying people as Black or Latino seems fine, whereas saying whites can be strange, shameful, maybe? What does it mean to be white in our culture? We have a sense of white identity. It's just generally hidden. In order to facilitate healing and discussion, we need to bring these topics out into the open. That's why I'm talking about this. That's why I'm saying this is uncomfortable. We need to talk about this. This is where we hear each other's stories and share our own stories. Tandeka, in addition to her difficult game, asks a difficult question of people. What was an interaction where you first identified as white? She says, as an account of the process of becoming white, this book, she wrote, is filled with personal memoirs by Euro-Americans of small, seemingly inconsequential defeats. Each defeat, however, when acknowledged, produces the disconcerted feeling that something about one's own white identity is not quite right. The sense of misalignment with one's own identity could serve as a definition of shame. And that's the place where our story begins. Shame. Wow, all the experiences were filled with shame of being white. She didn't create this. She was interviewing people and saw it and noticed this. Did I have shame in my experience with the person who handed out flyers? I mean, when I think back on it, I think, yes, I was ashamed that my classmate felt she was treated differently from me based solely on the color of her skin. I was ashamed because it never even crossed my mind that this was a possibility. It isn't like she said that. I'm like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, oh, wait. Whether or not it makes sense, that's her reality and that's how she's feeling. Wow. And I'm ashamed by all the times I've ignored or allowed myself to be the beneficiary of privilege, no matter how slight. When I was preparing this service, I was going back and forth between two children's books for the introduction. I had the Sandwich Swap and the Sneetches, which is in a bookshelf over there, but Dr. Seuss's The Sneetches. This is a well-known tale about the creatures who judge each other based on appearances. One has a star in their belly and the other has none, right? And the Sneetches are given a chance to change their appearance and chaos ensues because someone comes and says, I'll charge you some money. I'll take the stars off. I'll put the stars back on. He gets a lot of money and the Sneetches take their stars on and off. Now the tale ends with the moral that everyone is equal and the appearance doesn't really matter whether you have a star or not. And that's this sort of simplified message from the prelude, Black or White by Michael Jackson. You're going to be my baby. It doesn't matter if you're Black or white. Which is the reason I went with the Sandwich Swap. Because your identity does matter. Being colorblind is not the answer. The fact that you have experienced oppression or privilege is extremely important. Saying it doesn't matter what your identity is devalues who you are and what your life is with that identity, whether it's racial or something else. It's true with any identity. If I say it doesn't matter whether you're straight, gay, or somewhere on the spectrum, if I say it doesn't matter whether you're male, female, or non-binary presenting, then I'm unwilling to hear the truth about your experiences in your life. The only way we can care for and understand each other is if we start to hear what it is to live with each other's identity. I'm going to share another story from mine, and that's the only place I can truly share from is my experience. This is a story where I very consciously knew that I was culturally white. And I realized some huge differences our culture puts on racial identity. When I was in seminary, I served as a volunteer at a soup kitchen and a food pantry. Sort of apt for being in seminary to do things like that, putting my faith into action. Now, my immediate supervisor was a paid staff person. It was a Black lady named Judy. And providing food for people in need brings up a whole number of issues that I had not anticipated. Some people didn't want the food that we had to offer. And others wanted more than we were able to give. With finite funding and only certain stores that donated to us, the pantry had little leeway in how much and what sort of foods were provided. There are many instances where someone wanted more food or different types of food. And at one time, a lady who was also Black approached Judy and asked her for more food. Judy explained to the lady that we had given all that we could provide, but she would not listen to the explanation. She kept pushing back. So Judy came to me and asked me to explain the policies. I was sort of taken aback. I was like, why would this lady listen to me, a lowly volunteer, and not Judy, the staff person, the paid staff person? She's the official one here. She's the one with clout and power. And I don't know. Because my skin is light. Because I present as male. Well, I explained the policy, and sure enough, the response was positive and okay, thank you very much for what she had already received. That made me feel good and terrible. I felt good. I was the one with the power. I could tell people what our rules were. They would listen to me. I was in charge. That feels good. Oh my gosh. And I felt terrible after this incident. Even retelling it, I mean, it makes me feel, I don't know, is that shame, like ickiness? I mean, how could I, using my privilege as a white male, feel good? What do I do about this? How can I change who I am? Tandeka, in her book, saw this happening in her interviews over and over, that the Euro-Americans who talked of their first experience in learning to be white had great shame. She says, I eventually decided to use the term white shame to designate the complex of reactions called forth when, in an interview, the interviewee addressed her own contradictory racial statements, emotions, and mental states. I called the experience shame because it involved the discovery of an unresolved conflict that, when discovered, made her, the interviewee, feel flawed. I called the experience white because of the racial context in which she had discovered her internal conflict. That's a hard process. That's a hard process, but I challenge you to take part. And I challenge all of you to think of one such interaction. When is an interaction, if not the first, you can think of the first interaction or any interaction when you really identified as the race you are. Take some time. Sit with that question. When did you first learn to be white? When did you first learn to be Black, to be mixed race, to be a person of color? When did you first learn to be the race you are now? And then we share. Sharing these stories is an opening up, a deep vulnerability that we can share with people in loving communities here. For instance, this is a place we can be vulnerable and open, because this is also a place we treat others with care and forgiveness. Come here and be your true and broken and imperfect self. I will do the same. And we can be imperfect and we can make mistakes together. I'm sad we're not in person, because I was hoping for animated, mistake-ridden, humble, and open stories during social hour. Our beloved community is a great place to start a hard conversation about race, and we can do this over Zoom too, and next week in person. Start that difficult discussion of how you learned to be the race you identify as. And then through this opening up, this acknowledgement, this vulnerability, we can change ourselves. We can bring hidden issues about race into the open. This is what we can do. We can open ourselves to talking about our experiences in learning to be white or Black or any other point along this fairly arbitrary spectrum of colors and hues. Again, I stress the sandwich swap over the sneeches. Your identity, your experiences can't be washed away or changed. Your experiences are who you are, They define how you relate to the world. What experiences or experiences did you have that produced your racial identity? We can only speak for ourselves. We can only respond to this time. So take a moment to think about how you act in the world and why you act that way based on this thing called race. Find the negative and positive and see what can be done to help bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice. Because it doesn't bend by itself. I do not know the best way to change the world. But I'm happy to come together and exploring and questioning. There's no one right way to see how you grew up in your racial identity. Bring your thoughts and ideas back here to the beloved community of seekers. Because together, the questioning, the exploring can continue, can expand into a mindset, hopefully, of tolerance, of equality, of understanding. I end with a quote from Tandekka. I see a fork in the road. To my right is the well-trodden path. The vista includes books, workshops, committees, and projects, special programs, and workplace seminars about how to get along with them, that is, the Blacks. I hear the murmuring roar. What are we to do with about for them? What do they want now? Why can't they take care of themselves? To my left is the other well-trodden path. I look down that road and see stall after stall after stall packed high with books and government reports. I hear weary voices trying to figure out new ways to show them, the whites, what they're doing wrong. How can we stop them from being racists? Why won't they give up some of their privileges? Why are they so rigid and uncaring about everything except themselves? I stand at the place where both roads meet. I looked behind me and see new travelers journeying forth. These sojourners are America's children. The image fades as I offer a prayer for us all. Let us walk together, children. Amen. As we ponder these thoughts and questions and ideas, let us sing, "There is more love somewhere."
More.
Last week, I mentioned that an area church was destroyed by a fire. On January 7th, Faith Tabernacle lost its place of gathering and its place of worship. This is where we put our values into action. There is more love somewhere. And we can help to promote that more love, that somewhere can be here and now. We are taking up an offering this morning. We do not usually do this, and online it's a little different, but we're taking up an offering not for ourselves. This is an offering to help our siblings in faith. Please take a moment to click on that link in the chat or go to tpuuf.org and make a donation. You make a note that your gift is for Faith Tabernacle, and we will give all received funds to them to help rebuilding. Take a moment to think what it would feel like to lose our gathering space. Not just the financial cost, but the memories, the stories encompassed in those walls. Please be generous. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Westfall, a member of the CARE team, and a reminder that we are here for you, myself and the CARE team, the rest of the CARE team. We're a fellowship and community with friendship and relationship at its heart. We hold love and care for each other as the burning ember of our purpose. We embody the importance of care for each other every week. We set aside time for sharing the matters of our heart each week. If you have a sorrow or a joy which overflows into this beloved community, I invite you to come forward virtually, raise your hand so John can unmute you, and we will unmute you and you can please share, starting with your name.
We're going to bring this time of sharing to a close, singing Spirit of Life, and then I'll turn it back over to Cindy for a reflection. So the lyrics and song will pop up here in just a second. Thank you, everyone, for your sharing.
Joanne, please continue your healing. You know that we hold you in our love and light. John and Susan, thank you for sharing your experience with and privilege of working with people from diverse backgrounds. I think that Jerry's reflection reminded me that our brothers and sisters' trauma is our own trauma. And I think that's what a lot of us are dealing with right now with the new administration coming in tomorrow, is the trauma that we are going to be witness to, that we are speaking against and resisting. And Indy, thank you for your reminders from Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, outbalance hate with love. I'm going to carry that because it's so important. Hold your guard, hold your space. So even though I think there's a lot of us that are quiet, you know, the People's March yesterday, there were a lot fewer people there than the Women's March in 2017. I was not in attendance yesterday, although I was in 2017, and that makes me worry. But I think that we are going to be resisting and fighting in a different way now, maybe not in protests, but in keep moving, as Dr. Martin Luther King reminded us to keep moving. I think our trauma that we are about to see, not only the racial trauma and the trauma against the immigrants and transgender, but also the trauma that we're about to witness against our environment is concerning as well. So keep us all, each other, sisters and brothers that we are, to know that love trumps hate, and that we're gonna keep fighting and moving. And again, thank you all for sharing. Thank you for a great sermon, and Reverend Andrew. And I look forward to battling alongside of all of you. Thank you.
We do have one more song, and I know it's weird to sing in a space without other people or with one or two others. I encourage you to still do it. My family's looking at me like I'm crazy. That's all right. Put yourself on mute and sing out our closing hymn, "Soon the Day Will Arrive."
Torch must be passed with new hope, not in sorrow, and a promise to make a
We extinguish our chalices, our flames that we have kindled across the county, across the states on this morning, but we know that the flames of hope, of justice, of working together, of more love and more care in this world remain in our hearts. From the epilogue of Tandekka's book. The end of this book is a beginning, a place where new conversations about money, race, and God in America can commence. With this new beginning, loyalties need no longer be skin deep. Here, God's broken humanity can be healed. Difference will be affirmed as the grace of human engagement. The term person of color will now refer to every human being. Dare we dread of such a day? Yes. Let the church say, Amen. Amen and blessed be.